Welcome back to the latest edition of The Audible. I'm Bruce Feldman. No Stu Mandel. He is still on vacation. We think he's somewhere in Hawaii. But we have something better. We have another Fox colleague, former Notre Dame great Brady Quinn, who is a Fox Sports College as well as NFL analyst. Brady, thank you for joining me today.
No problem, Bruce. Thanks for having me on. And I'm glad I could fill in for Stu. It sounds like he's been taking a long vacation. And what's the deal with that?
I don't know. You know, he gets near a beach. He had a kid a couple of months ago, and I don't know. He's just not been the same guy. He doesn't have the same work ethic that Leinart has, at least in the off season. So,
being a Notre Dame guy, I don't really know how much of a work ethic that actually is.
Yeah, I'm gonna give you a couple of chances to come back at that. Just keep in mind, Jacob Ullman listens to this podcast, and you know where he went to school. So. Yeah, well, let's talk to you about your alma mater. They had a pretty big year last year. They're one of the few schools that they have a quarterback battle, but it's a good. I think it's a good problem to have. Would you agree? When you have two guys proven and another guy in Brandon Winbush, who seems really talented, that's a good place for Brian Kelly to be.
Yeah, I think so. I think most universities would love to be in the position that Notre Dame's in right now. Now, granted, that comes with some potential headache if you don't manage it right. And actually one school that was in that exact position last year after coming off of winning a national championship was Ohio State. Now, I think there are some similarities and there's some differences between what Ohio State was presented with in regards to their quarterback situation and with what Notre Dame is presented with this season going into their quarterback position. So I'll try to show you a little bit of both. You know, in Ohio State's case, you know, they had a guy in J.T. Barrett who had really kind of, you know, won them the Big Ten that season after replacing Braxton Miller, right? So I think a lot of people had seen the body of work and what he was able to accomplish. So coming into last season, I think a lot of people thought he, you know, should have been the guy, should, you know, at least in my opinion, that's how I felt, because mm-hmm. he had the greater body of work. Whereas Cardell Jones kind of led them. Now, granted, they were very, very, very pivotal games, given the Big Ten championship, semifinal game, national championship. But it was only three games, and it was a very, very run-heavy-oriented offense behind Ezekiel Elliott. So it seemed like everyone else was doing a bunch of heavy lifting around Cardell Jones. It wasn't necessarily him doing that. So, you know, they go into the season, and, of course, instead they do the exact opposite. And Cardell Jones ends up being the guy, and he ends up getting benched, and J.T. Barrett's in. And it's almost as if they couldn't really find a rhythm because they didn't know who to go with in the first place that would have given them the best chance at the beginning of the season. I kind of feel like Notre Dame's in a similar situation in the sense that, you know, DeShone Kizer now has the greater body of work. If you go back to last season, I think it was 8-3 as a starter, and Malik Zaire coming off of, the few instances he has of actually playing and starting. If you go back to the Music City Bowl versus LSU a couple years ago, then in limited action, you know, Texas last season, and then Virginia a little bit last year. And then even before that, the second half versus USC 2 years ago, when he kind of emerged onto the scene. You know, through those small instances, he's shown flashes of what he's capable of. I think he's got a lot of explosiveness running the football, maybe more so than Kizer, even though Kizer, I think, has like the second longest rushing touchdown for Notre Dame quarterback in its history. I still think he's the better runner of the two and probably the bigger arm. But you have this calm, very almost unwavered personality and way in which Sean Kizer likes to lead. I think the coaches see that, and they feel comfortable with that, and they feel like he's probably the better of the two at getting in the right position and into the right play. But I don't think it's going to – I don't know if it will play out that way, because you have to look at it from this angle, Bruce, and you could probably tap into some of this. You know, Malik will be graduated after this year, even though he'll have another year of eligibility. So you have to look at it this way. If you put in Malik Zaire first, and he goes out and he plays the way he showcased a little bit last season in some of the small instances that – we've seen in the past of him, you know, then you're not necessarily in a bad situation because Kizer's still a year behind. He's still going to have some time to, like, you know, showcase exactly what he did last season. Whereas if Zaire doesn't do well, you can always bench him, you can go to Kizer. And then, you know, Malik Zaire would be able to transfer and he'll still have that extra year. And then Brandon Winbush would be the backup competing against all the rest as they continue to stack up. If you switch it around the other way, and if they go with Kizer first, if you bench him and Zaire goes in and he flourishes and he plays really well, it could damage the confidence of Sean Kizer. Who knows if he can rebound from that? I mean, again, if you go back to last year, if you look at Notre Dame's situation with Zaire and Golston competing for the quarterback job, you know, Deshaun Kizer was nowhere even in the discussion. You know, Brandon Wimbush has a lot of upside, a lot of ability. If you go in and let's just say that scenario plays out where Kizer starts, doesn't play well, Zaire replaces him, and he ends up being the quarterback either at Notre Dame for another year or maybe even leaves because he didn't feel like he was treated right in the first place, who knows? But then you've got another guy, Brandon Wimbush, who would maybe be nipping at his heels looking to beat him out again. Like, it just doesn't seem like a stable situation and the best way to go about it. In my opinion, I always look a seniority should rule, and they should go with the older guy. And hopefully they will in this case. I think that's what's a little bit different than the Ohio State scenario. And there's X factors to both, too. I think in Ohio State's case, the absence of Tom Herman was the OC during the national championship year, which his absence had a big factor on how that offense struggled to really find a rhythm, regardless of the quarterback. And then in Notre Dame's case, I actually think the X factor is the fact that you've got a lefty and a righty, and your entire team has to adjust to a different spin of the football, and the fact that the plays are going to be formatted a different way, and teams are going to attack you differently based on the arm of your quarterback, because now his weakness is going to be the opposite side of the other one. So the whole entire team has to adjust around the quarterback, depending on which one's in the game.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the Tom Herman factor. I thought that was the most underrated or the overlooked aspect of what changed for Ohio State, especially when Cardale Jones hadn't played that much. When I went to the Combine a few months back in February, I know talking to some NFL coaches, they wondered how Cardale Jones's 2015 might have been different if Tom Herman was still there. That shouldn't be seen as necessarily a knock on Tim Beck or Ed Warner. Those guys are accomplished in what they do, but it's different. Whereas Notre Dame, at least, you know, Mike Sanford's still there. You know, the structure around him is different. You're an Ohio guy, just like Deshaun is. I got to admit, I saw Deshaun, you know, I was around him for a week at the Elite 11. It was a good group. He was definitely on the lower end. I was pleasantly surprised with how well he played last year. I did not expect it. You know, I actually thought Brandon Wimbush, who I had seen last summer, I thought Brandon Wimbush was the most talented of the three, and I thought he would eventually overtake Deshaun. Obviously, that didn't happen. Deshaun played well. I know Deshaun was a three-sport athlete and was a very good baseball player. I think he's supposed to be a pretty good basketball player. How much, when you watch him as a former quarterback, what do you like about Deshaun Kizer's game?
I just think it's his pocket presence. He seems to be unflappable in the pressure situations. I mean, if you go back to a couple of their losses during the regular season, they're on the road in what seemed to be some sort of monsoon going on in Clemson. And if not for Brian Kelly's decision to go for two, probably too early in the game, in my opinion, you know, you've got the team now kicking a PAT and going into overtime, and who knows how that game turns out. But then you go to the end of the season, they're playing Stanford on the road. I mean, look, he rushes in the go-ahead touchdown at that time in the game. It looked like his knee was down. The ball was short of the goal line. There wasn't enough evidence to prove that, per se, and leaving the extra additional the additional time on the clock ended up hurting Notre Dame, as Stanford had enough time to drive down the field for a last-second field goal, but very well could have been two wins on the road versus the Pac-12 champion and the ACC champion, and I think it would have been very meaningful, and it pretty much would have sealed probably their case for being in the national championship. I mean, that's how close they were in both of circumstances. Now, I know they didn't play well in the Fiesta Bowl versus Ohio State.
They did lose their best defensive player, though, for most of that game, right? Yeah, so
They're depleted with injuries and a bunch of other things that they had dealt with, though, throughout the course of the season. But, look, I think I love his presence. I love how calm he is. And he's just a football player in the sense that, you know, he's not the most athletic, like you pointed out. He's not going to be the one that you go down the field or really excites you as far as how explosive he can be or the type of big plays he can make. But he understands the offense. He knows how to get to his quick throws when he needs them. He knows how to protect himself when he needs to. And he works the system the best of the three. And I think that's why the coaches probably feel most confident in him going into a training camp this year.
Mm. You obviously lose some really, really talented player. I mean, if Jalen Smith isn't injured, I'm sure he goes way, way higher in the draft. From a personnel standpoint, looking at it critically, you know, you still have a great offensive tackle, probably one of the five best offensive linemen in the country, and McGlinchey, he's still there. Still some good speed. I think they should be good in the secondary. Personnel-wise, do you think this is a legit top 10 team when you look at the roster?
In all honesty, and it's not to take anything away from the guys that are going to be filling in, no, because I think these guys have more to prove than the roster last year did, in the sense of they don't have as much experience. I mean, we just saw that, you know, Corey Robinson, who they were looking at coming back, not only providing leadership, but also a reliable big body target, now decided that he's played his last game of football due to concussions. And he was a guy who I think was going to help add depth to a wide receiver core that's largely going to be relying now on Torrey Hunter to really step up and then kind of, you know, I guess take the torch from Will Fuller, who's the big time playmaker. So I think my big concern is you had guys who are not only talented, because I think the Notre Dame roster is loaded with talent, but they've proven it. We've seen it before in years past, and now we're looking at a team that lacks that experience, even though they come from good recruiting classes. And you and I both know, Bruce, that doesn't always equate to more wins on the field. A lot of the development of any player over the course of their career in college, it's going to start, obviously, in spring ball and going into training camp. But then once you get into the season, it's development throughout the course of the season. And these guys don't have a ton of game experience. So there's a lot of question marks in my mind about how, yes, they look very talented on paper and based off the accolades coming in and maybe some of the flashes we've seen, but can they do it on a consistent basis? And can they do it like the guys we saw go off into the draft this year, whether it was Will Fuller or a guy like John Smith or whoever else you want to throw into that category?
We had your old broadcast partner on, Tim Brando, about a month or two ago on this podcast. And Tim, who does a lot of ACC stuff, and I think is pretty close to Mike Bray, your alma mater's basketball coach, he seemed to think that Notre Dame, which surprised me, and I think it surprised Stu, that Notre Dame's run as a complete independent could be running away. They could be moving on and going to join a conference. I mean, do you buy that, A, and B, do you think that would be a good thing for the Notre Dame brand and the Notre Dame football program especially?
Well, do I buy it? I think there's some validity to what Tim said, and I've heard some of Tim's comments, and some of it makes sense. I mean, look, I think in the end, if you look at the way college football is moving, you know, the Power Five conferences are essentially aligning themselves, and if you're an independent, probably besides Notre Dame, you're essentially going to be left out. I mean, you could look at BYU or some of the other schools that are out there that are looking to try to jump into a conference. I mean, Bruce, I think you and I were out there for the Pac-12 Big 12 meetings, and that was some of the hot topic discussions of the Big 12 expanding and if a team like BYU would maybe fit in. I know that was thrown around a little bit out there. But you don't hear as much about Notre Dame only because I think the contract with NBC, and that's really what's hoisting them up, and their subtle ties to the ACC. So for now, it seems like they're fine. But yeah, once things continue to move along, you could potentially have the Power Five conferences ganging up against Notre Dame. That includes the ACC. If they force them to possibly join in order to be a part of the college football playoff system, which I think every Notre Dame fan wants, and everyone at the University of Notre Dame, the players included, want. You know, I've heard some comments sometimes by our athletic director, Jack Swarbrick, about, you know, possibly not even being at the same level if they were to, you know, pay student athletes when that whole discussion was going on about, you know, those Northwestern athletes unionizing and all that, which I just found absurd because I couldn't imagine the alumni and everyone involved around Notre Dame allowing them to join some other separate league where they weren't going to join everyone else and provide some sort of stipend or providing some sort of payment, whatever came to that agreement, even though it's a completely fictitious world. I just think that's part of the experience of Notre Dame. It's not just the education and the Catholic Church. It's football as well. They're intertwined into one another. So I think as long as the economics still work out from the point of NBC paying them the money for the contract that they have, I don't know that that'll be a reality until that ends or until they feel enough pressure from the rest of the Power Five conferences where they have to join in order to be a part of the college football playoff. And as far as a former player, I mean, I would love for them to keep their independence as long as possible. I think it makes for a more interesting schedule. To be honest with you, even their subtle alliance with the ACC isn't overly enjoyable to watch as a former alum, because I think you cut out some of the more fun rivalries that you have. You know, we don't see the Notre Dame Michigan anymore. That was so much fun. It's such a battle every year playing against them. And you see more of these uncommon opponents in the ACC, which I believe isn't necessarily up to the ranks of some of the other opponents that Notre Dame was able to schedule, whether you're talking about Michigan or whoever in the SEC or whoever out in the Pac-12 that you could add additionally to your schedule. And it's not as if we didn't have an ACC opponent every once in a while, nor we still had that, along with the mix of the other opponents that we had on a year-in, year-out basis.
Let me get back to your career a little bit, just because it wasn't that long ago you played there, 2003 to 2006. And you put up huge numbers, especially the last 2 years, 69 touchdowns, 14 picks. Were the last 2 years, was Charlie Weiss 2005 and 2006 for you, or was he there in 2004?
No, 2005, 2006.
So you had the big years when Charlie Weiss got there. I know a lot of people, you know, his contract, people still kind of, you know, make comments about. He didn't have a good run at Kansas. Obviously, Brian Kelly seems to have been a better fit there and has taken the program to another level. But for you as a quarterback, why was he a good coach? Like, what worked for him, and what do you think people maybe miss when they look at Charlie Weiss and what he did well there?
Well, there's a few things as far as how to address all of it. I mean, I always look at, you know, success is tied to quarterbacks statistically and win loss record and all these things, but when it comes down to it, you know, Charlie was smart in the way he went about looking at what he had as far as the talent that was on his team, and then playing to the strengths, which I think any good coach is flexible enough to do that. They don't just come in, run their system, and if they don't work, they push the kids out or they recruit kids to replace them. A good coach is always flexible enough to play to the strengths of the players that he has in order to win right away and win now. Charlie brought in his offense, one that he had been running with the New England Patriots, which was, the first off, was pretty neat because the first playbook I ever got was a New England Patriots playbook, and it was probably maybe 1.5 times thicker than what I had before, and it was front and back. So really, it was almost 3 times what I had originally had as far as any sort of playbook I'd ever ran in my life. And it was cool to sit there and watch all these tape of the New England Patriots, Tom Brady, because those are the plays you're running. This is the type of offense you're implementing. And it gave you so much control as a quarterback as far as the audibles, the alert systems, the changing of protections, the ability to signal certain routes to change the route or even the adjustment. I could lock a route if I wanted to keep it on versus certain coverage. You had all these things at your disposal, and it was just very unique and something that, you know, at that point in time, you didn't see a ton of other schools doing, only because you didn't have a ton of guys who were coordinators dropping down into the college football ranks to become a head coach and running that system. And nowadays, you hardly ever see it because everyone's got to more of a spread style system than all in shotgun. And not saying we didn't do shotgun, but a lot of things we were doing were predicated on my decision making out there in the field. All the week of preparation we came in with, we had gone through all the scenarios. I'd been coached by Charlie Weiss on what to do in certain scenarios, and then I was implementing it with my teammates on the field. I wasn't looking to the sidelines to get a player to get the adjustment from the coach, which seems to be the norm nowadays. So I think that definitely kind of piqued my interest and played to my strengths as a player when he got there for my junior and senior season. But again, I'm not trying to take credit for this because, as I initially said, it's a team sport. And we had a young team my freshman, sophomore year who had, you know, I mean, we completely reversed our numbers, at least my statistics for my freshman and sophomore year. So we had improved. We got better. I mean, we beat Tennessee on the road, who we weren't supposed to beat. Michigan at home, which is a top 10, maybe a top 5 ranked team when we played them. Michigan State on the road. We had beat a number of teams that we were underdogs against that season, but we had lost the teams we should have beat. We lost to BC and Pitt at home after we had leads and blew leads. So there's a number of things that didn't work out that season, my sophomore year, that ended up being the end of the Tyron Willingham era, which was unfortunate because we had a young team that was growing and maturing, and I think we started to begin to all put it together my junior, you know, senior year. And I think I was able to reap the benefits of that, and Coach Weiss was as well. And I think we started to see some of that success. And as far as, you know, afterwards, the hardest part was I think the expectations were set, and unfortunately they were so high that people didn't realize that we had a lot of guys leave who were talented, and it would have meant a lot to that university. And there was going to be rebuilding. It wasn't like we were all of a sudden going to go back to a 10-win team the next year. The schedule sacrifice enough, patience with that process. Although I don't know that, you know, anyone would look at Jimmy Clausen's career and say he was able to accomplish the things that he initially set out for himself there, considering that some of the things he had promised going into it, and obviously the way things ended.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious. I know we talked about this a little when I saw you recently. So at one point, Urban Meyer, who was a former Notre Dame assistant, there was talk that he could end up there. He ended up leaving Utah and ended up taking the Florida job. How do you think your career might have been different if he had taken the Notre Dame job?
You know, I don't know. I mean, statistically speaking, it probably would have been even better than what it was at Charlie White. And people would say, oh, well, they were still pretty good. Well, if you look at the type of throws, for example, he had always implemented his offense. I mean, his quarterback was very much involved in the run game with some of the zone man's game, whether that step back to Alex Smith or even down, obviously, with Chris League and then Tim Tebow. But that was always part of it. And so I would have been more involved in that way, and I think that would have played to some of my strengths, but also just from a completion percentage standpoint, the style of passing game. I mean, it was very much of, I don't want to say a deep and dunk, but the utilized screens, the utilized short passes that were high completion percentage passes, and again, the ability to now take some more play action shots and different things that help open up some more things downfield, which I think we were able to utilize as well. So I don't know that, how much different it would have been. I think, you go back and look back on everything, and part of the limitations for Notre Dame are recruiting. We can't recruit the same guys that Florida's able to recruit. So that's always going to be a limiting factor for any head coach when they're in there. There's a lot of things that they have to kind of get around in order to get certain players.
And it limits your talent pool that you can kind of recruit from. But I will say this, Bruce, I called Urban Meyer. And when all this was going down, I called him and actually spoke to him on the phone. There's a local radio guy that I grew up with in Columbus who gave me his number because he was in Utah at the time. And he called in, and then actually this radio guy reached out to me and said, hey, man, the negotiations aren't getting good. It looks like Urban's going to Florida. So he's like, here's his number. Try to call him and talk to him. So I called him and talked to him, gave my best pitch, but I guess it wasn't good enough.
What was your recruiting pitch like?
Well, my pitch was just like I tried to convince him of the fact that we had a young team that was building something. And, he doesn't have to go back any further than look at some of the wins I mentioned before, Tennessee on the road and Michigan State, and look at what we're capable of. And that, I would love for the opportunity to play in his system and then to play for him and have the opportunity for our guys to be coached, by him, given the success that he had had, previously. And obviously it being a place that, maybe was desirable to him considering his past coaching there.
How long did the call last?
Only for a few minutes. It wasn't too long. I mean, obviously he was busy trying to make a decision. And, I was at the time, a 19-year-old kid trying to convince Urban Meyer to go to Notre Dame. He's probably wanted to talk to his agent. He didn't want to talk to me.
Yeah. Did he ever tell you, hey, it looks like I'm not going to, or how'd you find out he was going to take the Florida job?
I found out like everyone else. I mean, the news kind of broke. And unfortunately, I partially found out from my strength coach, because Mickey Marotti was our strength coach for the first 2 years, and going with him down to Florida, and has since followed him to Ohio State. So I was aware of it because Mickey then left to go be with Urban in Florida.
Wow, so it really was subtraction by subtraction. Then not only that, you guys lose one of the best in the business on that side of it, too. I forgot about that.
That's the funny thing, Bruce. I don't know how much you and Stu break this down a lot, but, these guys, the strength coaches, are with players more than pretty much every other coach because of what the NCAA rules, really state. So you've got to have a guy that you trust in your head strength coach, and Mickey Marotti is one of the best as far as how he set up the off-season workouts, the type of tutelage he gave players, and making it kind of applicable to the game of football, because you're kind of limited, obviously, with what you can do practice-wise during that time of the year. And also you're talking about guys who, players come in, they need to put weight on, they need to get, bigger and stronger, and these guys are incredibly important in helping players not only reach their goals so they can become ready to play at the collegiate football level, but also, helping them to adapt to new positions. Sometimes guys come in and have to change positions, and with that, it comes the ability to not only put on more weight, but kind of change their physique as well. And I think a lot of times that gets underestimated.
Yeah, I mean, I remember talking to Coach Marotti when I think he first got to Ohio State, and, this expression that I'm about to use, I feel like, has become really cliche. It's like set the culture. But he really does that, and when Urban Meyer goes away for a week and he's sitting there and he's his brain is overworking to come up with all these different ways to do things. You know, I think when he gets back to Columbus, Mickey's the first one he calls to try to decompress and kind of work through, hey, we can do this or no, we can't do that kind of stuff. And so I'm, you know, that's his most integral assistant that he has wherever. I mean, he's had some great assistant coaches and position coaches, but just in terms of what he wants to do there, I mean, that's his guy. So, I mean, no question he's invaluable. So last year you did a lot of Pac-12, but you also did a bunch of Big 12 games. You saw a lot of really good quarterbacks in person. I wanted to kind of get to some of these guys for your impressions. How many times did you do UCLA last year?
I had UCLA twice that I remember. And actually, so we had UCLA's opening game versus Virginia, which was interesting, right? Because you hear all this hype about Josh Rosen and you know what he was in high school, and you never truly know how that's going to translate to the collegiate level, especially in your first game, even if it's home or not. And he was going up against the defensive coordinator in John Tenuta, who's notorious for bringing pressure, bringing blitzes, regardless of whether they hit it home or not. He just wanted to get hits on the quarterback. So I kind of thought it was going to be an interesting setup to see which one was able to win out. The disappointing fact was Tenuta really didn't bring that much pressure. And I think they were probably scared of UCLA's wide receiver group and some of the outstanding players they have on the outside, Jordan Payton and the rest of the crew along side of him, but they didn't press as much as I thought, and Josh Rosen absolutely picked them apart. I mean, I forget how many pass attempts he maybe had in that game. I don't know if it was over 30, but I might have been close to that number, and there was maybe two throws that I thought that were just missed, but even that, they were still kind of close, almost as if Rosen had put them in safe spots where their wide receiver could get them and no one else could, but every other ball that was either incompletion was either a drop or, I mean, it was something else. It was, you know, maybe the guy didn't get his feet in balance or something like that. But I mean, they were right on the money, and he really did light up the UVA defense. Not granted, after that game and once the season was over, you kind of look back and say, well, they weren't that great defensively. But nonetheless, it was a tremendous debut for Josh Rosen. Now, the counter argument to that is that I have the next game, a night game versus BYU, and their 3-3-5 defense that Bronco Mendenhall likes to run. That ended up being a whole different story. If not for Paul Perkins and his ability at the running back position to really carry the load late in that game, I don't know that UCLA would have gotten away with a win. And, Josh Rosen really struggled seeing the field well. I noticed it the week before when he put UNLV on the road. He missed some open throws that he had. He missed some reads that seemed a little bit uncharacteristic of him considering the first game I saw. But, you know, over the course of the season, you could continue to see the progress that he would make. Unfortunately, I feel like he was held back by the scheme. And that's not going to be an issue this year because Normal Zone, he's not there anymore. He's not the OC. And I think that'll actually play to the benefit of Josh Rosen as he goes on in his UCLA career and really onwards to the NFL.
What's the biggest thing you think he needs to work on at this stage of his development?
In all honesty, it has nothing to do with him on the field. You know, nowadays, so much light is shed upon these players off the field and who they are. And if he doesn't realize now that the spotlight is on him, he's an ambassador not only for UCLA, but for his family and everyone else that he represents, he has to mind his P's and Q's. He has to be willing to sacrifice for the next 2 years at a minimum that he needs to not put himself out there in any sort of unprofessional manner. Because as much as people think that the NFL scouts and organizations want to give these guys the benefit of the doubt that they're kids, they don't care. Because they're trading up like they did to get Jared Goff. They're trading up like they did to get Carson Wentz to play them right away. Now, Wentz, we'll see if he plays or not. But Goff, you better believe, is going to be the day one starter in L.A. And I believe Wentz will play this year at some point during his rookie season. No different than Jameis Winston and Marcus Mariota the year before. So, again, you're looking at these guys. And I think there's just been a few instances where I've seen Josh Rosen, and you'd like to think when you see him that he looks wise beyond his years, and you want to see that on the field and off the field. I think on the field he displays that sometimes, off the field he didn't, and that's what maybe some of the feedback I got from the coaches was as well, and that's what I would be most worrisome, as he moves on throughout his career at UCLA and really into the NFL. You know, everyone can be athletic and talented and be able to throw well and all that. It's the intangibles that come into play. So he's got to continue to be a student of the game and continue where some maturity goes.
Mm. Of the other young quarterbacks you saw, I think you had some Texas Tech. You saw Pat Mahomes. You had Browning from Washington, right? You had
yep.
You had Baker Mayfield. And
yep.
Which of those guys, I know Baker had the biggest season and his team did the best. Which of those guys are you most interested to see how they kind of take the next step? Is it Mahomes? Is it Browning? Is it what Baker does for an encore? Where are you on that?
I'll kind of try to answer all three. So I think I'm most intrigued by Mahomes. And it's because he runs a spread system that everyone's going to frown upon, but he's with a coach who I think is preparing for the NFL level better than anyone else, because Cliff played there at the NFL level. He coached briefly at the NFL level, so he knows what it's going to take. And he does implement some things as far as their reads and regressions that are going to be a little bit like what he's going to be asked to do at the NFL level, probably more in a two-minute drive than anything else, given their no-huddle offense. But he's most intriguing to me because of his skill set. He's the most athletic and maybe has some of the best arm talent that I've seen and I think will be coming out of this class. It's just a matter of if he can be healthy, if he can display with a level of consistency what NFL scouts and evaluators are looking for, and if he can get some help from his defense. Because, you know, hopefully when people evaluate Mahomes for the next level, they're not evaluating him as, you know, a guy just put up big stats and numbers. Hopefully it's for wins, too. And I know their defense at Texas Tech has struggled a ton, and they always have to kind of win a shootout, which is unfair to him. So hopefully he can get a defense to help him out a little bit this year. But I really think he has the entire skill set to be the guy at the next level, to be one of the top round draft picks. But it's all gonna come down to the football IQ and those meetings behind closed doors that you see at the combine and all that, to see how teams evaluate him, because it's not going to be displayed necessarily at Texas Tech with the offense they run. Now Browning is the guy that long term I think has the most upside. Could be a guy like Josh Rosen that we're talking about in a few years. He's going to be the number one overall pick. I mean, you look at the success he had coming up from high school, being one of the top kids in the country. Didn't go the whole, you know, bunch of tours and going around different universities and all that. Didn't necessarily, I don't believe he was a part of the Elite 11.
He wasn't. When I talked to him this spring, he's a guy who, they had a really good team, and that he just was with the high school team. He didn't mess with a lot of the other stuff that most college quarterbacks end up getting involved in. He didn't do any of that.
Yeah, and I think there's an area that I respect about that. You know, he's kind of to himself. He doesn't really care about, you know, what other people talk about what he needs to do. I think he went to a place with a great offensive coordinator, John Smith, who's going to actually do more for him as far as, you know, what he's going to be asked to do at the next level than maybe any other system in the Pac-12. You look at some of the different personnel sets they use, the fact that he's got his hands on the center of some of their play-action game, some of their checks and audibles and alert system. It's very similar to what he's going to be asked, you know, asked to do at the next level. So I actually like Jake Browning's ability to translate the offense that he's running in Washington into whatever he's asked to do at the next level. And I think they've got a young team. I mean, Miles Gaskin is a heck of a running back. They've got some other young talent around them. They need to get some more playmakers on the outside. But outside of that, he is, again, another guy who has the size. He's got a decent amount of athleticism, a compact motion. You know, there's not too many things I would try to change with that. I think as he gets older, he's going to have to develop the ability to get more of his lower body into his throws and drive more into throws. That should give him additional arm strength, but he's got plenty as it is right now to win them games and to be effective. So he's the other guy I'm really curious to see. You know, a guy who had a great season last year that you mentioned for Oklahoma, and Baker Mayfield, was a guy who, in all honesty, he most reminded me of Johnny Manziel. And I think a lot of people take that as a knock, or maybe there's a negative connotation that comes with that because of where Johnny's at now. But I only mean in the football sense. I think Baker Mayfield's a great kid, and I think he represents the University of Oklahoma well. But when you put on the film and you watch him, there's a lot of times where, you know, he's got an open guy that he's maybe not able to see in the pocket, or he's bypassing and trying to look somewhere else. There's times that he seems to be more comfortable outside of the offensive tackles than inside. And almost as if he's hoping that he gets flushed outside the pocket. You know, I think he's got a ton of ability. I mean, obviously to run the football, obviously to create, but he does take a lot of chances. And I think the more people see him, the more good teams and good defenses, in particular in the Big 12, will be able to hone in and kind of set up plans to be able to stop him. So I'll be curious to see if that happens this year. But overall, I mean, he's got one of the best skill sets of any quarterback in the country, as far as, again, arm strength, release, all of that. He's got the whole package. You know, Bruce, to be honest with you, and you see this a lot, I think quarterbacks nowadays coming into college are as prepared as they've ever been throughout the course of time to jump in and be the guy and to be pretty refined as far as their mechanics and as far as, you know, what they're asked to do. But it's the mental side of the game where they really have to take a leap at the next level as they transition throughout the college career in the NFL. But they have to understand more about the defense. They have to understand more about the different things they're going to be required to do at the NFL level that they're not doing at the collegiate level. That's my worry, and that's why, you know, you look at Lincoln Riley's system at Oklahoma, it's just not conducive to anything that he's going to be doing at the NFL level. And that's my only, you know, my real worry for him as he moves on throughout his career.
Do you think he's big enough to be an NFL quarterback? I mean, he's almost 6 feet. It's not like, I mean, he's about Johnny's size. He might be a little thicker than Johnny, but...
Yeah, I actually think he's built much thicker than Johnny just from seeing both of them. Mm-hmm. I think he's closer to a Russell Wilson to me as far as in size and maybe even ability, which obviously bodes well. The only problem is, I mean, Russell was accustomed to playing a little bit under center. You know, he did a little bit at NC State. He did some at Wisconsin. He had different, you know, offenses in both places were, again, an easier transition for him into the NFL level, whereas Baker Mayfield, it's going to look like a foreign language. I mean, he's going to have to, you know, restart and kind of take it new. I mean, regardless of his talent and ability, everyone's got that at the next level. Now it's going to be his ability to be able to, you know, understand the offense he's running and be able to spit it back out to the guys in the huddle and go run it, you know, once they break the huddle and get ready to run the play. And then that's where you really worry about that because he's got no experience calling a play in a huddle.
Mm. The one that's interesting, the most interesting to me of those three is Mahomes, because when you were talking about it, I did a story on Pat Mahomes for Texas football this year, and he is really raw. He was a baseball player and a basketball player. He didn't play at a huge place, and Cliff Kingsbury is proud to say he was the first one to offer him. He was, you know, wild in how he did everything. And he said last, and this is just this past year, Pat told me, he said, there'd be plays that I was going to freelance before the ball was snapped, and I knew I'm just taking off no matter what. And Cliff has tried to, you know, get him out of that. And it'll be interesting to see because they lost. They weren't, as you mentioned, they were terrible on defense. They were okay on offense because they had, you know, Jakeem Grant was a great receiver, and they had a lot of experience in the offensive line. Jakeem Grant's gone, and the whole offensive line, or most of it, has got to be rebuilt. So I'm curious if he relies on it, gets caught up in his instincts and just starts taking off again, or if he can be more patient and kind of go through what Cliff wants him to do because – like you said, he has great talent. He can throw from all kinds of arm angles, and he's got a big arm, and he's got really good size. But you know, can he keep himself on track? That's what I'm curious to see.
Yeah, I'm curious to see that as well. And I think again, if anyone can, Cliff can. I think what you do to help kind of feed maybe that urge at times, but also kind of allow him to do it in a more structured format is just kind of have more of those. Zone read option, run pass options, you know, where a lot of times he's got the ability to keep the football on the run, but also has a throw that's built in and behind with someone releasing downfield. And I've actually seen that a little bit in their spring practices. You know, it's kind of leaked out on the internet. Patrick Mahomes getting involved in some of that stuff. And, you know, you could see him kind of starting to keep the football, but then they'll throw in a no-look pass in behind one of the defenders. I'm not sure if you had the chance to see that on the internet.
I did. First. Cliff tweeted it out. That was interesting.
Yeah, so as I say, it's just it's interesting to see like how that the playfulness and then the raw ability of Mahomes kind of shines through more than anything then because he hasn't been necessarily coached to be more conventional. I think that's where you see the brilliance of Mahomes and his ability once he gets outside the pocket. What makes him so dangerous? But I will be curious to see if they struggle a little bit. I think they've got, you know, some talent kind of coming up. From talking with Cliff Kingsbury last year, that he felt like this year would really be a big year for them, at least offensively, regardless of the guys who left. It's just about whether or not they can help that defensive side of the ball.
Brady, so you'd been in the league for a while, and now you've been at Fox for a couple of years. What is the toughest transition for you as a former quarterback to go now and sit in the booth? I imagine studio is different, but just to be in the booth and calling games, what is the hardest part of that transition to make?
I think the hardest part isn't necessarily talking about the game of football. The hardest part is having to do it in a constrained constrained amount of time. I mean, the play clock that you had in the NFL was 40 seconds, right? So, yeah, granted, it winds right after the ball is placed dead and you're starting the next play. You don't have that in television. You know, you're hoping that you got a little window between when your play-by-play stops talking and before the play starts, because that's usually typically when you're supposed to get out. And when you're doing college football games, it's incredibly difficult to either show a replay and be able to, you know, illustrate something to the viewer to help either educate them or entertain them, or explain a point in a very, very small amount of time that could be anything other than stating the obvious. And unfortunately, because the game of college football is played so fast nowadays, that's the toughest transition, is being able to understand where you want to go, be able to get everyone on board with you down there in the truck, whether that's, you know, your producer or director, and then be able to put it all together and then get it out there on the TV screen while you're explaining it. And it truly is, it's much more difficult than I think a lot of people realize. And I tell people all the time, you know, to be doing an NFL game as an analyst, it's a more competitive business than playing quarterback in the NFL. I mean, the sheer numbers are 32 teams. Let's just say there's two quarterbacks on each team. That's 64 quarterbacks who have the opportunity to play in the NFL. If you are doing a game in the NFL, let's say everyone's playing a certain weekend, that's 16 analysts. You're competing against coaches and every other position from every other guy that's ever retired that wants to get a TV. So it's just, it's a more competitive business. And for players who want to get into it or people who want to go that route one day, they better realize that just because they get done playing, their work does not stop. The film is as much, if not more, than when you were playing, because you have to watch both teams, both sides of the ball, and special teams. So you have to digest and deal with so much more. You're reading more than you ever were before, because you have to understand the storylines and a lot of things going into the games to know the backgrounds of these players. So it's been a transition that's been incredibly fun because it's football, but it's also been challenging in the sense of how much work comes along with it. And it can be draining at times, and it can be difficult because, you know, this isn't something I went to school for. I was a poli sci and a finance major, so my plan B was very, very different than what's being presented in front of me right now.
What was that plan B?
You know, honestly, it was weird. I kind of got caught in between because I played 8 years in the NFL, and my idea was going into college that I'd go get my finance and poli sci degree. If things didn't work out with football, I'd have my degree to rely on, and I'd probably go to get my JD MBA and either go in the world of private equity or finance or maybe practice law. And if things went really well in football, I wouldn't have to worry about it. And I'd just maybe retire and I'd figure out what after then, but I'd probably be, you know, mid-30s and then or maybe closer to 40 and then go on with life. Well, I kind of fell in between. I ended up essentially retiring around 30 you look back and you say, okay, well, I'm far enough away from my education that I want to get more schooling, but I've been presented with the opportunity to do TV, which seems interesting and it's fun and it's cool and I'm still around the game of football. So I'm going to do this until I get a better understanding of if I want to do it for a long, long time or if I just want to do it until something else is presented to me in life. So that was kind of the way I looked at things, and I guess that's kind of where I'm at now.
Is the private equity stuff kind of in the distant, or is that something you go, well, if I really want to try to make X amount of money, I can go chase that. I have good connections because of where I went to school, because of the people I got to know, or is that just another lifetime from now?
No, actually, it's something that I kind of dabble in my free time now to a much smaller scale than what I would do if I was actually doing it full-time, obviously. But that's, you know, around a group of trusted investors that I've, you know, are either close to me because they're family relatives or that I've grown up and have been mentors in my life. So it's kind of a way where I'm getting some real world experience without necessarily hitting the reset button on going back to school and kind of finding a, you know, some sort of, you know, pickup from the last point that I was in my education. So that's something that I still try to do from time to time just because it also, you know, makes you feel like your world not just about the game of football. And not that there's anything wrong with that, that if it was, but you'd like to be a little more worldly too when you look at things. But I think it opens up new avenues, new ways of thinking about ways to describe to viewers what's happening on the field or ways to communicate to viewers, you know, what's taking place in the state of college football or even in the NFL.
Your brother-in-law was a great player at Ohio State, A.J. Hawk. He has played for the Packers for must have been a decade, right? Give or take.
Yeah.
He's looking at getting into broadcasting now. He has a good podcast that I've seen a couple of times that he does. What advice have you given him? And do you think it's different for him to get into broadcasting because he was a defensive player and his perspective is a little different? I mean, how have you watched his transition kind of unfold?
I think the one thing that's been amazing with him is, you know, he played 9 years with the Green Bay Packers. It was a team that drafted him, won a Super Bowl, all-time leading tackler, and then he finished his 10th season with the Cincinnati Bengals, which is a team he grew up rooting for. So, you know, I'm not saying he's even done. I think, you know, the right opportunity comes, he would definitely jump back in the saddle and go back into playing. But during the past few years, he's started this podcast, and it's him. It's just him by himself, man. Down doing these interviews, doing these podcasts. He's the one emailing and kind of cold calling people to get guests on. And he goes out to that Tahoe tournament and golfs in that, and a lot of time makes connections to people to get him on his show. But it's incredible to see what he's been able to do on his own. And I think it shows his willingness to work. You know, he doesn't want anything handed to him because nothing's been handed to him in his life. So it's pretty incredible to see the amount of work that he's willing to display, even though he's a guy who had an incredibly successful college career, an incredibly successful NFL career, and now as he starts to kind of begin looking into what he's going to transition into, he's starting and he's grinding like everyone else who's trying to get into business. So I think it's going to bode well for him. But it's interesting, you know, as far as advice, I haven't given him a whole lot just because I wanted him to kind of be who he's supposed to be, and he hasn't jumped into it with two feet in quite yet. I think there's, you know, still the urge to want to play, but when he does, you know, I'm obviously going to be there for him, trying to help him in whatever way I can. Not that I have, you know, any idea how it's supposed to be done. You know, I just keep trying to go out there and do a good job and try to be entertaining. But to your point, I do feel like defensive guys are at a disadvantage because when you look at the sport, I mean, everything's kind of geared to see points and all that. I mean, as much as we, you know, Buddy Ryan passed away, you know, today, and as much as we talk about the 85 Bears, how great their defense was, you know, everyone loves watching a more offensive game in a shootout. They love seeing that touchdown with you know, the last seconds ticking off the clock or that last second shot that goes in basketball. I mean, that's just how we're geared as a society. So I think the offensive guys have to, in particular quarterbacks, for example, and they make good broadcasters because they have to know the defense's responsibilities and everyone what they're doing out there so they can see it from both sides. I think defensive players can as well, but they have to truly be students of the game. And they have to be able to speak from it from both sides and be informative and educational, but entertaining at the same time. So, you know, I don't think he'll have any issue with that because he was a student of the game. He's a really intelligent guy. It's just about the matter. It's just about, you know, the fact of getting an opportunity and getting lucky. You know, I have to kind of realize that as I was transitioning out, I saw an opportunity. I was offered a great opportunity at Fox, and by Jacob Ullman, who we talked about before. And he gave me such a great opportunity. I told him it was something that I didn't know if I wanted to necessarily take a chance to be an arm in camp or to be a third, fourth quarterback on a roster with no chance to really compete, and instead build on this other career that seemed to have so much more potential for me. And that was kind of the decision I had to kind of come down to making because I realized how fortunate I was to be in the position that I was with the opportunity to work at Fox. So that played a factor.
Yeah, cool story on A.J. Hawk. The guy who recruited him, or one of the guys, his position coach at Ohio State, Mark Snyder, was one of the first people I met in the business. He used to recruit New York, New Jersey when I lived there. And we would go out drinking when he would come through. And they had a really good linebacker class. And they had one kid who was a five-star guy. And he said, the best one is actually the least recruited, and that was A.J. Hawk. And the five-star guy, he said, I don't, you know, they didn't know if he was the five-star guy. Might be a defensive end. He was a little more stiff. But, I, you know, for some reason, that guy was the five-star guy. A.J. Hawk was the three-star guy. But he thought A.J. would be the best one, and he turned out to be right. And I think Bobby Carpenter was also in that class. He turned out to be a really good player, too. But it was interesting how these things kind of play out.
Mike DeAndrea.
That's him. That was him.
I remember it, man. He was huge. He was big. And everyone looked at him and said, holy cow, that's a high school player. I remember when he was a senior year, seeing them on the front of those magazines, and you're going, this guy is jacked out of his mind. And you're right. And I think, you know what, the key to, I think, I don't want to say the key to AJ, but AJ's a great athlete. It doesn't matter. else, he's a great athlete, so he was going to be good at whatever he needed to do. It was just once he got the chance to go play football, he got the chance to get in the weight room, work hard, put on the muscle mass and weight and all that, and then he really just excelled from that point forward. You know, whereas this Mike Gandria guy, I would assume, was heavily geared towards football, heavily geared to just being a one-dimensional weight room guy.
Yeah, and sometimes some of those guys who the eyeball component where you see and like, wow, this guy looks great in shorts and a T-shirt, you know, sometimes those guys, their recruiting stock gets really overinflated sometimes. Maybe that was the case, maybe not. I don't remember the specifics. I do remember he was the five-star guy, and they were probably not as high on him as they were on the three-star guy. Just one other thing I wanted to kind of throw at you here. Now, I know you got a lot of stuff going on. I know you work with my old colleague Pete Prisco on the side. You have your own podcast with Jeff Darlington. I wanted to also talk to you a little bit, though, about the work you're doing with veterans and how you got involved with Third and Goal. If you can kind of, it's a cool thing, if you can kind of give people a little more of a background on it.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Bruce. So Third and Goal, Veterans Homemade, is a foundation started by myself, as well as my wife, Alicia Quinn. And actually, it was inspired by my father, who was a Marine in Vietnam. And it was back during my time with the Denver Broncos around 2010, 2011, where I did some visits with some different veterans at some VA hospitals and some bases. And, you know, I kind of said to my dad, I was like, I want to do something to help out with veterans. And we kind of collaborated on the idea of helping out, initially in the Central Ohio area, veterans who were wounded in combat, because when they were coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan with injuries sustained from IEDs and things of that nature, they were missing limbs and they became handicapped to the point where they needed to have some adaptations to their residence in their home. And we felt like, given my dad's skill set, being a home builder, and my ability to use the platform of playing in the NFL to reach out to these brave, you know, men and women who are soldiers who have served, it kind of worked out. And so we started off extremely small and tried to do one gift a year for the first couple of years. Then we've eventually grown and branched out as we've kind of taken a grassroots approach, because we don't spend any money on marketing or anything else. We just try to take whatever fundraising we can make off of our annual event. We have an annual golf event back in Columbus, Ohio, that obviously helped to privately fund it to help support whatever gifts and whatever donations we're able to make to a lot of the veterans that we're able to help out. So we've been doing that now for going on over 7 years coming up here in the next year, and we've continued to help. I think we've given gifts totaling to the amount of around $300,000 now. And we continue to grow at kind of a steady pace, but that's how we like it. And you can find all the information about some of the individuals you've helped, how you can help out, and all that at 3ng.com. That's number 3andg.com. And you can kind of find all about what kind of makes us special, what makes us different than maybe some other organizations out there.
Mm. That's cool stuff. Hey, the last thing. If Fox Sports had a college football of the college football group, who's the best quarterback we have?
There's no doubt it's me. And Weiner should tell you that as well. We can't even put Platt in the discussion. Platt, I'll give Platt this. He is by far and away the longest golf ball maybe that I've ever seen of anyone I've played with. I'll give him that. But I'm by far and away the best of all the quarterbacks.
I think Platt would probably be the best baseball player of the group. He did play in the minors.
I'd give him that.
By the way, I give Leinart this, because Leinart did win the Heisman. I think Matt's an awesome dude, and I think he does a good job. The day you came in, when we were taping one of those shows, and I don't know how it came up, and it came up in a hurry. It was like, hey, if we had a team, and you looked at him and go, what position are you going to play? And he goes, I'll play receiver. I don't care. And he just kind of laughed about it. I thought that was pretty good.
Well, I will say this brief. I mean, I love Matt. I mean, getting to know him now, obviously different than playing against him as a competitor. You never had any ill will, but it was just, you know, you were pitted against each other, so you wanted to beat each other. That was part of it. But, you know, the most awkward moment we've probably had was, you know, we both went out to the Seattle Seahawks with his former college coach, and we were competing, me, him, Seneca Wallace, and Tyler Thigpen for a quarterback spot. And, you know, they ended up selecting me. So that was kind of the last battle we had. It's one that was behind closed doors. No one got to see. But, you know, in the end, that was kind of the last comment. competition we really had versus one another. So it's kind of interesting.
You really had to zing him like that.
Rivalry, and for one that, you know, where Matt and I were pitted against each other all the time, that was so public, that was kind of the last one that we had. And it was, you know, that kind of started the end of his career. I don't know. I think he was in Buffalo for a little bit, and that was it. And then I still played another year, and then it suffered a back injury, but still was looking to play that following year as I continued on in my career. So it was just kind of interesting how it worked out that way.
So you're going to claim the last man standing on him, huh?
Well, I mean, technically that would be the case, yes.
I guess so. I would assume you can lift more than him, so I think.
I mean, he's much better at yoga than me. We've been through that, man. I'm telling you, we're very competitive.
Yeah, you know what? He's a good basketball player. I think
he's a great volleyball player too.
Do you say, are you saying that derogatorily? Almost like the yoga line.
No.
You're gonna give him.
No, that's true and legit. And actually, they just won the what do they call it? The sevens or something. There's some sort of volleyball tournament there
yeah.
at the beach. In Manhattan Beach, and then he's been a part of the winning team, I believe, the last 2 years.
Yeah, he's got a good. He's very active.
Beach volleyball is no joke. I've got a lot of respect for beach volleyball.
He's also very active in the local basketball community here. His rec league team with Alex Holmes always wins.
Really?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know what kind of basketball they got out there out in Southern California. I mean, I'm not exactly sure. I've never played basketball with them. I'd love to do that sometime.
Yes, well, maybe Fox can stage like a you and Matt Olympics and everything.
There we go. See, that would be fun. That would be awesome.
Lord knows we need the programming, so we can work that out. We'll have Jacob hook that up.
Yeah, get Jacob on that. He'd be all over it.
Yes, he might be he might be rooting for Matt, though. So.
Yeah, there's no doubt he's rooting for Matt. He's never going to root for – actually, he did tweet the other day, the Notre Dame-UCLA game my senior year. That was the only time he said he was – I forget how he phrased it, but he was extremely happy by the outcome of that game and even was rooting for us in the closing seconds to beat UCLA, which I guess was the only time he's ever rooted for Notre Dame in his life, he told me.
I believe it. all right, Brady, I appreciate all your insight and your time. I would encourage you guys to follow Brady. It's at third, and it's the number 3RD_GOAL. That is his Twitter handle. You can follow him and find all the stuff he's doing. He's on Sirius. He's talking NFL. He's doing a lot of stuff. So, Brady, I appreciate the time. Sorry, maybe next time we'll have it when Stu is here. You guys, both Ohio guys, can smooth over your differences. So.
Yeah, sounds good. I'm looking forward to it, Bruce. Thanks for having me on.
All right, see you, man. Thanks.